Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
On this last day of the second quarter, thank you so much. Of course, that also coincides with the last day of this Supreme Court term. As usual, the court saved a number of blockbuster cases for the very last day and handed those decisions down this morning, including, of course, one of the big ones on birthright citizenship, which, no surprise, President Trump, given it was his executive order that the court shut down in a split ruling, has reacted to on Truth Social, calling the decision, or the decision to uphold birthright citizenship, too bad for our country. But he says it could easily be made up for in Congress through legislation. No long and unwieldy constitutional amendment is necessary, though I would imagine that is going to be the subject of much debate in the days and months and years ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the leader is ready to tackle that right now, as we're still trying to get the housing bill signed, among other issues. He's right, though. This would be the way to do it, is through Congress, and it's not a path that this administration has taken. A lot of the political analysis, though, and we'll talk to Rick and Doug about this later, is that it was never really even about winning for this president. It was about seen trying, being caught in the act, and he can certainly talk to his base about that.
Well, yeah, and I would imagine we're going to continue to see him do so, knowing that even though the court didn't rule with him on this case in this instance, they sure gave him a lot of victories over the course of this term.
That's right. And we've got not a couple tariffs, to pick through today. Not in tariffs and not in mail-in ballots yesterday. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about what we learned today with Tyler Kendall. Our Washington correspondent has made her way to the Supreme Court, where she's been the last couple of days, and back now with what was a more rambunctious crowd a little bit earlier. Tyler, let's start with the birthright citizenship case, the reaction that you saw on the ground there, and the opinions from the court. When you listened to arguments that the president himself attended, a lot of people thought they knew where this was going.
Right, Joe, this decision was widely expected because we got those signals from the Supreme Court justices that they were wary of the Trump administration's executive order seeking to restrict birthright citizenship. Even at the time of the oral arguments, we saw the Chief Justice John Roberts call the administration's legal position, quote, quirky. So even, you know, President Trump himself alluded to the fact that he didn't think that this was going to land in his favor. As you mentioned, once this decision came down, we did hear an uproar here on the ground of the Supreme Court because this had some pretty broad-reaching implications when you think about how this really was a central plank of President Trump's immigration agenda. But ultimately, the Supreme Court upheld that those key five words in the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, that if you were born in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, you are a U.S. citizen. The Trump administration didn't want that specific provision to apply so broadly, but the Supreme Court ultimately pushed back on it and sided with what has been longstanding legal precedent.
Well, Tyler, when we consider a new precedent that the court is setting as well, let's talk about the campaign finance oriented case. On partisan or ideological lines, they threw out longstanding limits on how much a political party is able to coordinate with individual candidates over the course of a campaign. Walk us through the implications of this ruling, potentially as soon as immediately as we look to November.
Right. In fact, Kaylee, there has been reporting that the political parties have actually held back their spending because they were waiting to see how this Supreme Court case would come down, because it's going to dictate their strategy going forward, in particular when it comes to the advertisements that you typically see on the airwaves. This is considered to be really monumental for campaign finance going forward. As we look ahead to November, I can see Capitol Hill from where I'm standing across the street from the Supreme Court, and the control of Congress is really those razor-thin margins, which means every dollar is ultimately going to count towards these parties. Now, this was the National Republican Senatorial Committee versus the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, and Republicans had basically argued that these caps on coordinating between the candidates and the political committees was unconstitutional because it restricted their free speech because they weren't able to essentially coordinate on their political messaging. And the Supreme Court here ruled in their favor. And the upshot that you need to know is that under this law, candidates get a more preferential rate when it comes to TV advertisement slots, but now these political committees are going to be able to get that preferential rate, which essentially means that the fundraising dollars are going to go even further than they did before in a bid to influence voters as we head into the midterms.
All right, Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall live outside the Supreme Court on a scorcher in Washington, but an important day as well as the court makes history. Thank you so much. And as we consider what Tyler was getting out there, the actual financial implications of that, certainly if you're a broadcaster selling advertising slots, this may actually have an impact for you as you're looking ahead to political spending in November. But then there's the wider political considerations as well, because as we alluded to, Republicans do have the cash advantage in this cycle, at least. So on that note, we turn now to our political panel. Rick Davis is with us, Bloomberg Politics contributor, Republican strategist, and Stonecourt Capital partner, alongside Democratic strategist Doug Farrer, principal at Maywood Strategies and former senior advisor to FTC Commissioner Lina Khan. Doug, I'll come to you on just that gap first and foremost. The RNC, the NRSC, and the House affiliate as well had $256 million in the bank. That's double the amount that Democrats have at the party level right now. So how concerned does this make you as a Democrat ahead of November?
It's definitely concerning. I mean, the Republican cash advantage was always there, and now it'll be augmented by this ruling. You know, I think in this upcoming election, there's a lot of wind at the backs of the Democrats because of the unpopularity of the president, his policies, and his sort of pronouncements and his repainting of the reflecting pool and all these crazy things he does. So I think it will be muted by that a little bit. But in the long term, as we saw with Citizens United, these sort of opening up of opportunities for Republicans who are always going to have more cash to use that cash more effectively in ads and in other coordination is going to be a problem for the Democrats. It's also going to change the Democratic strategy. You've got an ascendant left wing worried about corporate power, worried about billionaires. And now you have an incentive for Democrats running for office to seek out billionaire patrons and make policy concessions to them to juice their campaigns. So I think the net effect on the Democrats immediately is a little bit blunted by the possible blue wave. But over time, it'll change our politics, frankly, for the worse.
Well, no, we don't have a lot of surprises in this ruling, Rick Davis. But as somebody who helped to draft McCain-Feingold, as you've mentioned, and has seen this coming, I wonder your thoughts on what a campaign manager does differently in light of this ruling than what he or she might have done yesterday. What does this mean practically?
Yeah, I think it really, you know, does away with independent expenditures, right? I mean, almost every federal election had a commensurate independent expenditure outside the party, independent of the campaign, that could raise unlimited amounts of money and spend it. The downside was that you didn't get lowest unit rate on your TV advertising, sometimes four times more money you had to spend on an ad than the party committee, the campaign committee, which is significant. If you're spending, you know, $10 million on TV and the outside group has to spend $40 million, that's why you see so much money going into these outside groups. Now you can rationalize all that and streamline the decision making. So outside groups don't have to actually guess as to what kind of ads you want up there to attack. So it does actually give more control probably back to the party committee and the campaign committee. That being said, it's an explosion of fundraising at this stage, right? We used to worry about the $1 million donation. Now we worry about the $1 billion donation. In 2024, 300 billionaires gave over $3 billion to parties and to campaigns. It's an extremely huge acceleration of money into politics. And all you got to do is look around and say, hey, how is that making it better? No, it's making it worse. At some point, all of that will crash and we'll have another round of reform. But until then, this is the new reality.
Well, it's just incredible to consider. I was going to ask you, Doug, if this somehow ignites a fundraising fire under wealthy Democrats, if they know this outcome here, knowing that there was the structural gap in terms of the fundraising capabilities of either party, would you be surprised to see more $1 billion donations from high profile Democrats?
It's an interesting question because strategically you're right that the incentive is there. But if you look around at what happened in New York last week and what may happen in Colorado and in Michigan, what you have is an ascendant group of Democrats who have very, very strong views about the rising oligarchy in this country, who are very concerned about monopolies, who are hoping to have much more populist economic policies, running into this incentive to raise money from a handful of billionaires. So the party's at war with itself over this particular dynamic. And it, in some ways, getting a billion-dollar donation from a Democratic billionaire in your campaign may actually harm you with some of the base who believe, having watched what happened under the Trump administration, that the billionaires are the ones who are really in charge. So I think you'll see a bit of both, but there'll be big pushback from within the party for candidates seeking patrons the same way that President Trump has a patron in Elon Musk, for example.
Yeah. Wow. Rick, I want to turn to the birthright citizenship case, court upholding the 14th Amendment, but this was not a unanimous ruling. What do you make of what the court said?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to me. I'm surprised it wasn't a unanimous ruling. I didn't think the reading of the 14th Amendment was really that subjective. The reality is there's politics at play at the Supreme Court. And I think that the ultimate decision wound up in the right place. But the fact that you had three justices to bend themselves into a pretzel to find an argument to rely on a no vote really shows you the dynamic that's at play inside the court. So look, at the end of the day, we'll remember this only as a victory for the 14th Amendment. And who knows? There's all kinds of rumors about retirement. I think they're just rumors, but maybe this could actually ignite a really interesting legacy issue when it comes to what happens in the last 2 years of the Trump presidency when it comes to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, Justice Samuel Alito not retiring. That story was retracted by NPR. But to Rick's point, we very well could see that. That's always a question as we consider a majority and a president who may want the power
Clarence
to
Thomas
appoint.
Was on the Hill yesterday.
Well, yeah, and we all remember RBG in particular. So the kind of succession question on the court aside, Doug, I would love for you to weigh in on the birthright citizenship issue as well. And the president's call specifically for Congress to address this now, to be able to pass a law. He does have Republican majorities in both the House and Senate, but is that a politically appetizing endeavor ahead of the midterms, even after them?
Probably not, and I'm sure Rick would agree with this, but you know, if you're betting on Congress to do something, you're probably going to lose your money. I think, you know, listen, I didn't go to law school. I'm not smart enough, but I just read Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, and it said all persons naturalized in the U.S. Are citizens of the United States. So I don't know how you can wrap yourself around the axle to figure out a way to say that this isn't clear and plainly obvious what they intended to do here. And I think that's the politics at play that Rick talked about on the court. And that's a huge problem because the Supreme Court has shown time and time again that they are willing to undermine the most democratically contested branch of government, which is Congress. And we're talking about nine unelected people who really have no responsibility to the voters. And so I'm very concerned about the credibility of this court following all of these rulings, but in particular this one. And so it'll be something to watch, especially if Alito or someone else retires, where this goes.
Pretty interesting to see Justice Brett Kavanaugh concur and dissent. I didn't know you could skin the cat quite like this. Rick, he writes, Congress could, consistent with the 14th Amendment, amend or otherwise enact new legislation establishing exemptions to birthright citizenship for children born to foreign citizens unlawfully or temporarily in the country, but Congress has not yet done so. So are we done here?
Yeah, I think we're done here. I mean, I'm especially entertained by the president's admonition of Congress to act right away when he's told them you can't act or do anything until the SAFE Act is passed. He told them about housing legislation. Why didn't he just sign that and get on with it? But now we're going to do a constitutional amendment? Yeah, good luck with that, buddy. It's really kind of a mess in Washington. And that's why in the past, before air conditioning, they'd let everybody go home and not try to legislate. So I suggest maybe they pretend that there's no air conditioning and all go home for a while and cool off.
There's some wisdom there, Rick Davis. I'm still waiting for someone to suggest that it'd becomes part of Reconciliation 3.0. Rick Davis and Doug Farrar, great to have you both in our great panel. Coming up, as Kaylee mentioned, an important conversation with Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, the namesake, yes, of the Slaughter case that the Supreme Court ruled on yesterday. She's with us straight ahead here.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We try to distill everything that we have heard from the Supreme Court, not just today, but yesterday. It's been two doozies in a row here with birthright citizenship in the fore today and a president of the United States taking to Truth Social to talk about this ruling, knowing that the Supreme Court, while divided, upheld the 14th Amendment, the president saying it's too bad for our country, but we can easily make it up in Congress through legislation with the support of the president. He says that has now been determined during this process. No long and unwieldy constitutional amendment is necessary. Congress should start today to work on ending expensive and unfair to our country birthright citizenship. I think we've established this hour that that's probably unlikely, certainly in this session of Congress, for lawmakers to get their arms around such a massive issue. And so we start our conversation ahead of our talk with Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, who, of course, is the namesake of one of the most important, what the president says is the most important case of this term, with his ability and power to hire and fire. Eric Larson is Bloomberg News legal reporter and has been watching all of this perch from his perch in New York. It's great to have you back. Eric, if we can start with the 14th Amendment here, you could argue that this or the tariff ruling were probably the most important for this term of the Supreme Court. Many are surprised, however, that birthright did not bring a unanimous ruling. What are you looking at today?
Well, you know, I hadn't heard from too many experts saying that they were predicting a unanimous ruling. But what we did hear was predictions about what we got, which was a 6-3 decision, which obviously is not what Trump wanted. He wanted those two conservatives, the three other conservatives, to rule against birthright citizenship. But these justices asked pretty hard questions during these oral arguments, and this is kind of what we were expecting. You know, the 14th Amendment, the citizenship clause to it, has been challenged before, but it's been over 120 years that this precedent has been in place. And Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the majority that this case was not going to overturn that precedent, that there were no arguments had been presented to justify doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so precedent, obviously, was not overturned in this case. It was, though, in the case yesterday, the Slaughter case, the 91-year precedent, the Humphreys executor rule, now effectively out the window. Eric, how should we consider the long-term implications of what this actually means for presidential power and agencies that have operated, at least to this point, independently?
Yeah, it's a really good point about that Humphreys executor precedent being overturned. It was another old one. It shows that the conservative majority on this court doesn't shy away from overturning precedents and expanding presidential power. I think in the case of the Slaughter case, this was something that Republicans and conservatives have been trying to do for a long time, to get rid of this precedent. I think arguably what we would see here is that presidents, starting with Trump, will now be able to have a firmer, control over the ideology of the political ideology of all of these dozens of regulatory agencies. I think it's too early to know exactly, how that will pan out, what that will mean for sure. But even if every future president will take advantage of that, some may, of course, want to have some bipartisan cooperation in these agencies.
All right, Eric Larson, Bloomberg News legal reporter, joining us from New York. Thank you so much. And joining us now for more on the Slaughter case specifically is its namesake, Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, the fired FTC commissioner by President Trump, who, of course, fought that and took it all the way to the Supreme Court, a challenge that, of course, ended with this ruling yesterday. Welcome back to Bloomberg TV and radio, Commissioner. When we consider President Trump's words about your case and the court's ruling, he called it the biggest and most consequential decision issued by the court, which he says gives tremendous additional power back to the presidency. Is that the right characterization?
Yes, I think that's exactly the right characterization. And it's exactly why I think the ruling is so disturbing. It is a massive transfer of power from Congress to the president. And it's a transfer that transforms these agencies that Congress set up to work for and be accountable to the people into instruments of the powerful and of the executive.
Well, kind of interesting to hear you agree with Donald Trump in a live conversation, Rebecca. Thank you for coming back to talk to us here on Bloomberg. What's the result of this? The door keeps swinging every 4 to 8 years. It's not just the administration that changes, but the entire administrative state.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's important to go back to the history and understand that this is not a partisan issue, and it certainly shouldn't be a partisan issue. The case that was overturned yesterday, Humphrey's executor, was the case of a conservative, pro-business Republican who FDR tried to fire from the FTC because Commissioner Humphrey was running around calling the New Deal socialist, and FDR didn't like that. And so the precedent, the 91-year-old unanimous precedent, actually originally protected a pro-business Republican's ability to provide transparency and accountability at the FTC. The other way I think about it, it's not about whether a president can set policy or pick people to work at agencies. I think about it a little bit like corporate boards. We have a requirement that publicly traded companies have independent boards of directors, not so that the CEO can't be in charge, but so that the decisions that the CEO makes are really in the best interests of the shareholders of the company and not just a way to do favors for his pals or enrich himself. These boards and commissions, like the FTC or the Federal Communications Commission, were set up by Congress with a similar structure to make sure that their decisions were in the best interest of the shareholders of the American government, the taxpayers, and not just to benefit the executive.
Well, when we consider the setup of these independent commissioners, there is usually a partisan split, if you will. You can't have a clean tie on a lot of these boards, as you put them. Rebecca, so what would be lost if a president is able to effectively just get rid of anyone who was appointed by a predecessor of a different party? Is it not the case that usually you would still see things swing the way the administration wants it to swing, given the majority that would be there on the commission?
Yeah, I think what is lost is a lot of the quality of the debate and the discussion and the work that the agency produces. I started at the FTC as a Trump appointee, as a minority commissioner in the first Trump administration. I was in the majority during the Biden administration, back to the minority. So I've seen all sides of it. And what I learned from experience is that there is enormous benefit to the agency and to the public from having a leadership structure that requires you to engage with people from different political perspectives, understand their point of view, try to find consensus. There's an incentive to find consensus where you can so that decisions will have durability and stability throughout administrations. And then to air for the public respectful disagreements when you can't reach that consensus. And that quality of debate and discussion and consideration is absolutely lost if we move to agencies that are just going to swing wildly one way or the other. And I think the downstream consequences are not just at the leadership level of these agencies, but if the principle that the court articulated in my case holds, it also decimates the civil service, for example, or any of the sort of career expertise that we have over centuries worked to build up in our government so that it can really do its best work on behalf of the American people.
Of course, your case, Rebecca, was delivered in its decision alongside a separate and more narrow ruling on Lisa Cook's case on the Federal Reserve. I don't want to turn you into a legal analyst. We're not going to run through all the decisions here. But knowing that this is about her potential hiring or firing, I'm wondering what you thought of this very narrow ruling that, to the extent that I read it here, still allows for her potential firing if the administration can prove allegations of mortgage fraud. Did they move the needle on this case or not?
Well, I think it is actually a really important distinction. The president attempted to fire me, or successfully now fired me, for no cause at all, just at will. He tried to fire Lisa Cook for a cause. I think it is a pretty clearly pretextual cause. But that is consistent with what the statute that enabled the Federal Reserve in 1913 and the statute that enabled the FTC in 1914 allow. It allows commissioners to be removed for cause. And so what the Supreme Court has done has said, yes, that rule is valid and applies to the Fed, but it doesn't apply to the FTC or the other independent agencies for reasons that are very difficult for me to pin down in any kind of intellectually coherent manner. I think it's important to recognize that there were only two justices who took the position that I could be fired and Lisa Cook could not be. It is the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh. The other conservative justice said all of us could be fired and the liberal justices said none. But the two who switched positions, I find those decisions very difficult to reconcile from any sort of intelligible constitutional law principle. I think they're pretty more easily understood as sort of outcome oriented. We want to protect the Fed because we're worried about its effect on the economy. But for the agencies that are supposed to be watchdogs for the American consumer and honest businesses, we're not so worried about it.
We're almost out of time, Rebecca, less than a minute left. We obviously know what this Republican president has wanted to be able to do in terms of exercising power to get rid of people that he doesn't want in these positions. What would your advice be if a Democrat is in the White House next? Should they take advantage of it?
Well, listen, I think the first thing that needs to happen is that Congress needs to reassert its authority and its constitutional responsibility to check an out of control executive. And that means oversight. That means using the power of the purse. That means using its own role in the nominations process. And I think that means electing members of Congress from both parties who are willing to do that. And that is the first step to getting the system back on track.
She's a former commissioner on the FTC and central to our conversations these past 48 hours. Rebecca, it's great to have you back. We thank you for joining us here, as always, on Bloomberg.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Stocks up, as Charlie mentioned, to end the second quarter, the best quarter we've seen for U.S. equity benchmarks going back to 2020 when we were coming out of the COVID pandemic. Wow. Pretty remarkable to consider that in the run we've seen in certain stocks in particular, like semiconductors heading for a record quarter, despite all the volatility we've seen. We've seen a lot of volatility as well in other areas of the market. Oil, as Charlie mentioned, is lower today. We're back below $70 a barrel on WTI as we look for progress in talks, although they're indirect talks today between the U.S. and Iran in Qatar. And the question as to whether or not that will mean oil prices continue their declines. We heard President Trump talk about that in the Oval Office yesterday.
They're going to Qatar. I think they've already left, or they're just about getting ready to leave. So we'll see how that goes. But we're doing very well on that front. But the meeting in Doha is going to be perhaps important, perhaps not.
Let's get to it. With Jeff Mason, Bloomberg White House correspondent, joins us now from the North Lawn of the White House as we wait for some news on this round of talks. Indirect, Jeff, is how they're being described. What then are Kushner and Witkoff doing in Doha? Iran says it's in town, but not at the table. Who are these two gentlemen talking to?
Clip you just played, perhaps important, perhaps not. How do you interpret that? I don't know. It sounds like, for now anyway, the president and the administration are happy that any kind of talks are going on. This is part of what was laid out in the memorandum of understanding to stop the war. It's 60 days of negotiations on the nuclear program. But your question is good. What are Witkoff and Jared Kushner specifically doing? Certainly overseeing the technical level talks that could include everything from additional details on the Strait of Hormuz to the nitty-gritty on the nuclear program, which I might remind our listeners and viewers was the reason that the president and Israel went into this war in the first place.
Well, yes, the nuclear program was what they initially wanted to address, Jeff, pretty quickly. Of course, they were faced with the challenge of trying to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which the Memorandum of Understanding was supposed to do, but obviously that has been the subject of much contention in the days since it was signed. What is the status right now in the Strait, and does what Iran is saying about it match with what the White House is telling you and everyone else?
Well, I think that's a good question, too. Certainly the president has said repeatedly that he does not want there to be any sort of a fine system by Iran or other countries, for that matter, that would tax or tariff or put any kind of levies on ships going through the strait. But that has been one of his biggest political and economic challenges, is essentially putting the genie back in the bottle that came as a result of this war. And by that, I mean Iran was not controlling the ship that were passaging through the waterway before this war. Then they learned something that they must have known all of these years, which is that they can. And that's what they've shown since the war came out, and that is exactly what the two sides are negotiating over right now. You asked what is the exact status? I don't have an update on that other than to just remind us all that over the weekend there were additional attacks between the two sides. So this ceasefire and the state of the strait, as it were, are all very fragile.
Boy, will there be a third round of talks, if we can refer to these in that fashion? I don't know if they're all equal, Jeff, but it took us some time following the first negotiations with J.D. Vance to learn if there would be a second round, where and when. We're still trying to qualify that today. Will there be at some point a tick-tock or a more predictable path for negotiations?
You know, if past is prologue, Joe, I think it's hard to say that there's going to be anything predictable related to these talks or this conflict. But the MOU, as we were discussing, does lay out this time period. And that raises another question that I would just add, which is, will they have a deal to, you know, a broader peace deal on the nuclear program, on the strait, at the end of that 60-day period? To get back to your question, the only way to do that is to continue talking. And then to come up with some sort of agreement that both sides agree to. And the timing of that is not uninteresting from a political perspective, because if it's successful, President Trump would have something to flag when he goes out on the campaign trail this fall ahead of the midterms. If it is not successful, then it will no doubt be another albatross over his neck as he tries to make the case for Republicans to maintain control in Congress.
Let us know what you're hearing, Jeff. As always,
we'll
Jeff
do.
Mason with us live from the White House. And with gas prices in mind, we can give you the latest here at $3.84, the national average, according to AAA. But that is not low enough, according to the president, Kaylee, who was back out on Truth Social once again last evening, accusing, I guess, refiners, presumably, of gouging.
Yeah, he has suggested previously that it's the big oil companies. He's named Exxon and Chevron and said that they aren't lowering prices at the pump enough. Of course, it doesn't actually work like that with retail gas stations. But the president has maintained $2.50 on average for a gallon of gas is what he thinks is commensurate with what is currently happening in the street and where crude prices have gone. So let's ask an energy and geopolitics expert about that. Michelle Brohard is back with us, head of policy and geopolitical risk at Kepler. Welcome back, Michelle, to Bloomberg TV and radio. It is true that we have seen oil prices come down. As I mentioned, we're below $70 a barrel on WTI, once again, south of $73 on Brent. How quickly, in terms of pace and trajectory, could we see that reaching levels that would bring gasoline down to something like $2.50 a gallon once again? Is there any path to that being realistic?
You know, Kaylee, thanks for having me again. And it's really difficult to get to that price, especially because we need all of the refineries in the Middle East to start exporting gasoline. We drew down a significant amount of gasoline on the water, as well as jet fuel and diesel. And so product prices remain really high. This statistically, the gasoline prices as a percentage of Brent are the highest that we've ever seen them. I think that's true. Maybe around the highs. Certainly gasoline cracks relative to crude are as high as they were in 2022 during the Russia-Ukraine war. And what we really need to see is refining capacity coming back online in the Middle East, exports of products resuming, because it doesn't matter how much crude you have, you need to refine it to make gasoline. And last night's upset of the refinery in Pennsylvania certainly doesn't help the gasoline situation in the Northeast. And so gasoline prices are going to continue to remain high as demand remains high and production just continues to be lagging the demand response.
So does the president not display knowledge of how this works, knowing that there's gas already in the ground paid for at higher prices, knowing that integrated oil companies don't set the price? He's referring to retailers in this case, yeah. Must quickly react to this statement and do what they know is right. Are we going to see, maybe he believes pressure is in fact potentially effective here. Could we see retailers and refiners cut some short-term deals here to target $2.50, or is that simply not realistic?
You know, the only thing that would be even remotely possible to get gasoline prices down would be to implement some sort of gasoline export restrictions out of the U.S. Mm-hmm. I find that unlikely. I think we've talked about it before, and it certainly has been a topic of conversation since the war began, that export controls out of the U.S. are very difficult to implement. It certainly is possible. Constraining gasoline inside of the U.S. will bring down prices maybe in the Midwest and around Texas, but still the Northeast is going to remain relatively high until we can get tankers moving that gasoline to the Northeast. So it is difficult. Obviously, we all know that gasoline prices are not controlled by the majors, but it's controlled by the market, which is the market that we have. Yeah. We, of course, gasoline prices are high. You can have refiners switching from making jet fuel and diesel to gasoline, but then you're going to have even higher jet fuel and diesel prices, which we already have really high prices there. What we really need are the refineries in the Middle East restarting their refineries and being able to export their product out of the Strait of Hormuz.
Well, so let's talk about that export capability for these Middle Eastern countries, Michelle, and whether or not they're going to be able to do so freely without paying tolls to Iran or Oman. Iran consistently suggests that there are going to be fees or whatever you want to call them associated with the administration of the Strait of Hormuz. What realistically will that mean for the global energy market if they are able to implement it, knowing that the U.S. says that's a non-starter?
You know, The new fee structure that has been, your previous guest said, let the genie out of the bottle. And that is exactly what has happened. And it's very, very hard to put that genie back into the bottle. And not just with Iran and Oman. It's going to raise prices, obviously, to get that out. And obviously, the Saudis and the Emiratis have already talked about creating pipelines that are going to move product and crude away from the Strait of Hormuz. So there is going to be some things that are going to logistically change inside of the Gulf. But I think the bigger question is what do tolls mean for other straits, the Strait of Gibraltar, the Strait of Malacca, right? Like once you introduce that you have control over these natural straits and that it can really be a revenue stream, that takes on a whole new meaning for some of these countries, that, like Morocco and Spain, for example. Morocco could receive fees for ships going through the Strait of Gibraltar. That changes what Europe looks like. So I think that it's so much more, the fee structure is so much more than just Iran and Oman. It is applicable to many, many straits in the world that currently you can pass through that are free.
Wow, that's terrifying, the idea of a new global tolling regime. In the meantime, Michelle, we heard that we were on the precipice repeatedly of physical shortages. You mentioned jet fuel. Start right there. In Europe, in the UK, in Asia. Was that about to happen, or did we dodge a bullet somehow?
You know, it's such a great question. There, at the very beginning of this war, I created this war endurance model, like how long can the world last? And what I found, of course, which we have found over time, is that some countries just ran out of fuel, right? Like East Africa ran out of fuel. Some of the Asian countries just ran out of fuel, right? And then measures started getting implemented. So you started to look at demand in these three buckets. Bucket number one was just demand response relative to price, which is a normal demand response. The second was a demand response relative to policies. So countries were putting into place these policy measures to curtail demand so that they didn't run out of product, because running out of gasoline or diesel in a country that needs it for emergency uses, such as emergency vehicles or hospitals, really needed to make sure that they kept their product. And then you had a demand response for just countries that just ran out. And so while the rich countries were able to buy more fuel from the global market, they were able to stay relatively balanced while the poorer countries suffered. And that's really what we saw. So did we run out of fuels? Yes, some countries did. But when you look at the United States and Europe, obviously we had plenty. So were we on the precipice? It's possible. It's just possible that the richer countries would have maintained while we would have continued to see the poorer countries diminish in supply of products.
Michelle, we're almost out of time, but given everything that you have just been describing around the genie that has been out of this bottle, with the fees in the Strait of Hormuz, with the difficulty of getting refining capacity back up and running, what's a realistic price of a gallon of gas by November in your mind?
You know, because of the Strait of Hormuz, the traffic through the Strait of Hormuz has still been relatively constrained. I think it's still down at least 85% from the peaks that we had prior to the war. You need to get that traffic back up and moving and the refineries back up and running. And I think we all know that there are theoretically some mines in the Strait, so those need to get cleared. So by November, gasoline prices could still be well above $3 a gallon.
All right. As far as oil goes, we're still looking at $69 a barrel, WTI 73 almost for Brent. Michelle Brohard, great conversation. Kepler.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.